Swimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Swimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, so hello, Harry, and welcome to Swimmer's Netter.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about your book, which is Habits of Success. But before we do that, I'm sure that listeners know a lot about you already. I'm sure they know a lot about your work as well. But could you just give us a little potted history of your career to this point?
So after university, I taught abroad, taught in Japan for a year and then India for a year. And then I was a history teacher in North London and then made the jump to South London. And while I was there, I was asked to be responsible for teacher development. And so I got increasingly interested in the evidence, kind of what should I be asking teachers to do? How can I ask them to do it? And followed that down a rabbit hole, spent a couple of years as a researcher, and then have just spent the last 5 years with Ambition Institute working on various programs designed to help teachers get better.
Okay, so again, the book that we're talking about today is Habits of Success. That's Getting Every Student Learning. And if I might just read from the introduction, Harry, if that's okay for listeners, in terms of giving them a little bit of an introduction to the book. Obviously, we're going to discuss it in detail as we go through. So in this book, Harry shows how teachers can use behavioral science techniques to increase motivation and improve behavior. The book addresses five challenges that teachers face in encouraging desirable behaviors. So choosing what change to prioritize, convincing students to change, encouraging students to commit to a plan, making starting easy, and ensuring students keep going. And also, this book is a resource that teachers and leaders will go back to time and again, and there's lots of practical examples in the classroom, and this is definitely something that, you know, teachers can revisit and share as well. So like I said, the book is Habits of Success, Getting Every Student Learning. And as we release this podcast, Harry, it should hopefully be out. So I think it's out this week, isn't it?
It's Friday it's meant to be, I think. So yeah, big moment. I've actually finally got a copy in my hands after 3 years trying to make it happen. It's dead exciting.
I felt bad about that because I saw a few tweets from people like Alex Quigley and people who got the book in their hands. And for listeners who are looking, I've got two copies. I've got two copies.
Yeah, I mean, to raffle them both off.
I've even got one that says, and I would probably have to cut this part, but it just says, bound proofs are not for distribution. I won't
tell anyone if you don't.
Right, moves on swiftly. So the first question, if we might do, Harry. So you've been very candid in the introduction to the book that you, like thousands of other teachers, you know, around the world, struggle to get students to learn. This book is designed to help the reader get students to learn better. So can you just tell the listeners about the universal challenges of the classroom and how this book uses behavioral science to get every student learning?
Yeah, so I think the epigram of the book captures the challenge in a few words, and I'm not going to better it. So it's from Mary Kennedy, and she just says, schooling is mandatory, but learning is not. And so we've got, it is the law that children must go to school or be educated in some way. All schools have policies designed to get children in the classroom, sitting down with the right equipment, in the right uniform, at the right time. And difficult as those all are for some students and in some schools, it's a lot harder to actually ensure that students are thinking hard all the time. And Daniel Kahneman makes the point very clearly at the start of his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Like, the brain isn't really designed for thinking hard. It's effortful. And I find, you know, if I concentrate on something for a long period of time, I'll just kind of want to stop and literally do anything else. And so we've got this challenge that learning is intrinsically difficult. And then you've got the added social dimension of the classroom of actually there are 29 people who maybe I'd rather be talking to than the teacher, or 29 other things I might rather be thinking about than whatever the challenging aspect of maths or whatever it is that I'm struggling with. And I think it's quite liberating. So Kennedy talks about these as being persistent challenges. No matter how good you are at teaching, it will always be, and how experienced you are, it will always be difficult to get all students learning because it's a hard thing for students to do and it's a hard thing for teachers to encourage them to do. And in particular, motivation is really difficult. And I do think we've spent maybe too much effort trying to get students motivated when motivation's really fickle. You know, like some days I'm really motivated to go for a run or whatever, and other days it's raining and I'm not so much. And in the same way, the idea that we'll come up with a magic motivating lesson that's going to motivate 30 individual students, each with their own hopes, dreams, fears, everything else, almost ends up being pie in the sky. And so what I've done is look at behavioral science, which is just, you know, what it says on the tin, the science of looking at human behavior as individuals and in groups, and say, well, what can it offer us that we don't already know, or what fresh perspectives can it give for us about how to encourage students to start learning and to keep learning? So I broke it down into a series of steps, but they work together towards forming a habit. And I ended up focusing on habits, essentially, because habits stick when motivation doesn't. So if I always go for a run on Saturday morning, it kind of becomes part of me if I do it for long enough. I mean, it just would feel weird if I didn't go for a run then. And so then when it's raining or I'm tired, I just go and do it anyway. And in the same way, rather than trying to motivate students and then risk, you know, well, actually students having a bad day, so they're not going to do it, I think part of the key is helping students to form really powerful habits that will stick when they're tired, when they're under pressure, when they're whatever, and carry them through both a year or 2 years or however long they're spending with you as an individual teacher and beyond.
Great stuff. So in terms of the book, and obviously there's an accompanying website as well, isn't there, Harry, that that the listener can also go to. So what kind of things should a listener ask students to change, and how could they specify what students need to do?
Sure. So my first choice is that they specify a habit. But sometimes habits are too big and complicated, and you just need things to be better next lesson, in which case I think the aim is to specify a bite-sized goal, which is a thing that a student can do straight away. But sticking with habits, because I think that has to be ultimately our goal. I ended up saying that the thing that we want is something called a powerful habit. And I took a lot from a book called The Power of Habit by someone called Charles Duhigg. He has this wonderful chapter about various things, including a company called Alcoa, who make aluminium. And he talks about how when the new chief executive comes into Alcoa, it's making losses, there have been strikes, it's not efficient, like nothing's going well. And he sets one simple priority. And he says, look, we're going to have no injuries on the job. There's too many injuries. And we can have zero injuries, which, you know, is particularly challenging when you're dealing with molten aluminium at temperatures of 1,000 degrees. And he sets up a mechanism to make this happen. So he says, anytime there's an injury, within 24 hours, there needs to be a report on my desk. This is a company with 100,000 plus employees. There needs to be a report on my desk saying how the injury happened, how we're going to make sure it never happens again. And I think that's really powerful because it's super simple, but it's also meaningful. So simple in as much as it's really clear, like, is there a report on my desk in 24 hours or not? There's no kind of, well, you know, maybe we'll have a meeting at some point about this, that and the other. But it's also meaningful because what it did was it drove change. So in order to write this report, you have to have really good lines of communication between the CEO and the employees. The managers and the workers have to be working together, and managers have to trust the workers, and the workers have to give up a little bit of control to the managers. And you have to work to do not only make the plants safer, but make them run more efficiently. So powerful habits, simple and meaningful. And I think the same applies for working with students, right? So there are loads of things we could ask students to do as a habit. We could ask them to like check to make sure their tie's done up whenever they come into our classroom. And if you're going to wear a uniform, you might as well wear it neatly. But I don't think that's going to have a transformative impact. But I think if we pick a handful of habits, and preferably one at a time, we pick something that we think is simple enough that we can ask all students to do, but it's going to make a bigger impact. So that might be making a particular kind of plan just before writing an answer in an exam, or any time that you write an answer. And the idea is, well, it's not just writing a plan, because that's going to help calm the student down, make sure they're accessing prior knowledge, so on and so on. If you're thinking about social behaviour, it might just be pausing before you speak, counting three, and that's something that you could get everyone in the class doing, or writing, asking students to write down what they're thinking rather than calling it out. So you have to things that are really small, but which will have hopefully an outsize effect.
Absolutely. So in terms of, you know, you talked earlier about motivation. So why do you feel as it that some students don't think that learning is worthwhile? And how can the listener go about kind of convincing them otherwise?
Nailers, natter, just talking to teachers.
Let me give you a really oversimplified answer to this. Often, for some students, they feel that learning isn't worthwhile because it isn't. There's a really good paper that Rob Coe quotes on this, where he said, well, actually, if you often try and your effort tends to lead to failure, the rational thing is to stop trying. And so I think the single most powerful thing we can do is make sure that students experience success. Had a look at the literature around the interaction between achievement and motivation. And from what I could tell, it cuts both ways, but the effect is more powerful in terms of achievement boosting subsequent motivation. So we look at kids and say, oh, you know, so-and-so does really well because they're really motivated. And often it's the other way around. So-and-so is really motivated because they're used to doing well. In concrete terms, what I think that looks like, and obviously it's much harder as soon as you're working with 5, 30, however many students, but if you can create an activity which ensures that a student will succeed and then immediately come back to it and say, okay, great, now let's do the next step. And, hey, look what you've done. You can do it. This is worth doing. And I think those two things then help students to build a virtuous cycle in which they get used to, well, actually, you know, the activities you give me do kind of make sense and they do allow me to do X, Y, and Z and it is worthwhile. Oh, actually, I quite like history this year or whatever it is.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, in terms of a follow-up to that, so you've talked about the motivation and you've also talked about, you know, making things simple and easy to start. So for students that sometimes, you know, particularly around September, maybe I'm just stereotyping, I haven't got any research to back that up, but students who may want to make a fresh start or mean to act but don't, you know, how can the listener help those students really commit to action?
So, yeah, and this happens to the best of us, right? We're like, oh, yeah, I'll definitely do this. And then next week rolls around and it hasn't happened. And there's a couple of things that there's really strong evidence for. One is just making a really concrete plan about when and where you're going to act. So if you think about setting homework, think about thousands of times you've said, you know, this is homework, write it down in your planner or whatever. If we just also got students to write, this is homework, write it down in your planner and write down when and where you're going to do it. And that, for, you know, it's very easy to write down, you know, answer questions. You write down answer questions when? Wednesday, 4 p.m. And picking, helping students. So, you know, the one-shot thing is to say, okay, write down when and where you're going to do it. If you've got students who are consistently struggling, and particularly if you're a form tutor, working with them, so, well, you've written Wednesday, 4 p.m., but you normally do football training on Wednesdays, and sometimes the bus is late. So when's a better time? When's a better day? So working with them to pick times. And again, so we're then working back towards this idea of helping them to set habits. Tied to this idea, like once they made a plan, help them to turn that into a commitment that other people know about. So they might be committing to the details about the when and where, but they might also commit to aspects of the how. So like, okay, if you've left your planner here, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to, you know, ring so-and-so and they're going to remind me what the homework is. And small things like that are so obvious, but actually if you're a, you know, a 12-year-old child, and particularly if you're not the most sort of I don't know, there's so many reasons why you might sort of halfway intend to do it and then hit a small barrier and, oh, you know, I can't remember where it is, I'll do it tomorrow. And if you work through with students, what are you going to do if you've forgotten the homework, what the homework is, you're helping them to know, oh, actually, I talked to Sir, I talked to Miss, and they said, if I've forgotten what the homework is, I should do X. So committing to the details and also then committing to other people. So people are more likely to act if they've said to others, I'm going to do such and such by such and such date. So even if it's just saying, well, you know, make sure that you share this with your family, or asking families to have a look at the homework planner as well, small things like that can again just help nudge students. And it, you know, I'm not going to pretend that this is going to suddenly get all students doing this overnight, but I think what it can, each one of these little things adds up and gets sort of one more student, two more students, three more students doing it that you then don't have to chase, and you're helping them to form the habits that we're after.
Yeah. And I mean, you've talked to the end of the chapter in the conclusion about making plans have short-lived effects, particularly for goals which require ongoing effort. If we want students to act and keep going, we need to make initiating action easy for them and help them turn isolated success into a habit. That's really powerful.
Yeah. And I think I quote from a book called Switch early on where they talk about, you know, often we jump from a kind of, we've asked them nicely, we've told them why, we ask them nicely again, and then we kind of say, well, they obviously are deliberately not doing this thing. And again, if you think about your own life, think about how often, you know, there's a thing that you kind of know you should be doing. You're not doing it out of malice. You're not doing it because you've forgotten or because you're busy or whatever it is. And I think anytime we remove barriers, we make it easier to do things, we make it more likely that these things happen. It's, you know, it's not rocket science in that sense. So one way of doing this is just to make the first step impossibly easy. And I had some really good sort of crowdsourced suggestions about this. One of them, I think, was you know, just if students won't pick up a pen and write, just say, pick up a pen and kind of write nonsense, like write anything that's in your head. And clearly that doesn't solve all of our problems. That literally only solves one problem. But if we've got the student with a pen in their hand, we can then say, well, okay, now write me a sentence about X. Now write me, well, that's a good sentence. Could you make it a bit longer? And so on. So an impossibly easy start. Another way of doing that would be to say, well, okay, you know, the start of any lesson or activity should just be recap, because that's something you should be pretty confident that students can do. Maybe it should be a recap of something that they covered 2 years earlier if you've genuinely got motivational challenges in the class. Again, I'm not pretending that's going to solve everything, but if that gets students engaged, you can then push them a little bit further. Another way is just to set a default. So say, you know, we're always going to start by doing X. We're always going to start by doing 5 minutes silent writing at the start of class. And that way, they've done 5 minutes silent writing at the beginning, so that they're already heading in the right direction. And we get used to defaults really quickly. And then the third big thing I think here is just practicing. So before we ask students to do things individually, just practice it with them. And then they know what they're doing. They can just repeat what they were doing and then, again, build on it.
Absolutely. And one thing that runs through the book all the way through is these workshops that you're using and also these checklists. And I said before about the companion website that you've got to go with that. And in the chapter on helping students to keep going, and I found that workshop 5 particularly useful as a practical application. So would you mind sharing the getting students to school on time example for us?
Yeah, sure. So this came out of a research ed in Sweden I did about 2-3 years ago when I was doing early bits of the book. And I said, well, okay, we'll talk through some of these ideas. And we said, well, okay, let's use this to solve some of your challenges. And loads of people in the room said, students turn up late, they don't turn up, or whatever it is. And so some of the ideas came from that workshop. What it came down to is if we think about this idea, first of all, of what is the goal, setting a really clear goal for the behaviour we're after. We want students to be in school as much as possible and to be turning up promptly. I talk about the idea that a senior leader who's trying to build this is going to try and narrow that down and say, well, okay, there's loads of reasons why students may not be here on time. There's loads of reasons why they may be struggling, but what are a couple of things that we could do? One is to make sure that every day students have at school, they feel like they've had a great day. Because going back to this idea of success, creating success, if they feel like Tuesday was pretty good and they enjoyed themselves, they're more likely to come back on Wednesday. And the second is to just try and chip away at all the different barriers. You know, the teachers can't ever do all the things they would want to do for all their students, but you can always chip away a little bit more. So then said, well, okay, what could we do to be inspiring and motivating students? What could we do to make this day feel like a great day? And what can we practically do that teachers could reasonably, you know, if our senior leader trying to make these changes is trying to change what all teachers are doing, they're setting themselves a second behavioural challenge. So I suggested, well, okay, a really simple thing that you could ask all teachers to do is just spend 90 seconds reviewing what students have achieved at the end of the lesson and to be describing or having students describe what do they now understand, what can they now do. And that's appealing to me because it doesn't require any extra planning or this or that. Literally, it's just carve out a little bit of time and talk about these things. And lots of teachers will be doing that anyway. And then secondly, to offer a hook. So to say, well, okay, you're brilliant at this today, and here's what we're going to be doing tomorrow. So students have some kind of hint that, you know, tomorrow is going to be interesting, worth coming into. And then I also thought potentially in terms of motivation, role models are really powerful, but often the role models we put up are, you know, perfect kids. You know, so-and-so attended 100% and got 14 A stars and is now first in the school going off to Cambridge or whatever it is. And that's great. And those stories are fantastic and we should celebrate them. But they may not always appeal to a student who's bumping around with like low target grades, doesn't want to go to university, may not manage to go to university. So I said, well, okay, what about turnaround role models, who are people who didn't used to attend, didn't used to like school, and sort of came around year 9, year 10, year 11, whenever, and now value school and have got something out of it. So potentially seeking role models like that, you can say, well, okay, here's someone superficially more like you and who might have something to offer you, and to train up people who are in this position. Because often what you find, I think, is when students were quite anti-school and then came round, they some of them can be quite evangelical about that and want to kind of pass on their success. It's a way of reinforcing the success of these turnaround students and transmitting it to others. You could then think about this idea of planning the change. So to say, you could ask students, or teachers themselves could work with students who are struggling to attend, just with this really simple time. Okay, what time are you going to get up? When are you going to set your alarm? What are you going to do if you miss the bus? And so on. And to share those commitments with others. You could think about wanting to, in this idea of making it easy, you could think about wanting to reinforce or to make coming back to school easier. So if you've missed a few days and you turn up, and where's your homework and where's your books and so on. So finding ways to ease students in gently and to you know, potentially the senior leader might sort of start the day with them, reintegrate them gently into lessons, make sure that they sort of feel at home. And then a couple of powerful last things. One, to just keep a really close eye on what attendance is like, and potentially to sort of put up the headline figure, and not put up the headline figure from the whole year, put up the headline figure from yesterday. Say, well, okay, actually year 8 or, you know, 8B, 87% attendance today. Let's make that 95. We just need to get two of our friends in. Now, clearly, I should stress, you should, if a student like needs not to be in school because they're in hospital or something, you obviously cut that out of the figure. This is something people get het up about. It's like, obviously, don't include people who have a really good reason for not being in. And then helping students to feel like they belong in the school. So that might be sending messages to them, asking their friends to send messages to them, checking out they're okay, and so on. And just monitoring these effects and seeing what's working, present it back to colleagues, and keep refining until you get the kind of changes you're after. That's a kind of, I've thrown a lot of ideas at you there, and clearly individual teachers, individual senior leaders may not want to try all of those things, but I think behavioural science offers us quite a lot of different things, and at least some of them are likely to help with some students some of the time, and not a huge additional cost in terms of time or effort.
Yeah, and again, what I like about the book is that you can have that discussion, can't you? Because you can encourage you to use this book with a senior leadership team, say, for example. Yeah. And if that is a particular area that you're looking at in attendance, then the case studies, the workshops, and the ideas that you're throwing up there, you can take a couple of those habits and then see whether they're going to be any use to use in your particular school. And it goes right across, Harry, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, you can do this in primary school, you can do this right through to college, can't you? So you've got the full kind of continuum there. Okay, right. I'm going to delve into, and we do something we discuss a lot on this podcast, and I always say this is the reason that we discuss this is because it's kind of the day job. So we're going to talk a little bit about behaviour, if that's okay. Now, not from the sense that we normally discuss behaviour, in terms of leadership and management of it. It's chapter 6 that we're going to talk about briefly, about how we can use those kind of habits that you've talked about to help students to stop. So can you just tell us a little bit about how we can go about helping students to stop?
So, yeah, there are sort of two elements of this. Element one is, like, are students motivated to do whatever the thing is that you want them to not do, whether it be shout out, I don't know, like throw things, do graffiti, don't do that, you know, whatever it is. And so part of it is saying, well, okay, if they are motivated to do that thing, we need to find some way to discourage it. And I would suggest, I think it's always helpful to remember, students are never unmotivated. They're just not motivated to do the thing that you want them to do. And in the same vein, when students are doing something undesirable and you say, why are you doing that? And they say, I don't know. Like, they've always got a reason. And so if you can get to an honest conversation with them about, okay, you know, you must have had a reason. Go on, what was it? or, you know, I want it to look cool in front of so-and-so, whatever it is. So first of all, you know, getting to that and finding ways, hopefully, to make it a little bit less motivating. So one might be pointing at social norms, saying, well, you know, actually, most people, including most of your friends, aren't doing X. Another way might be to look at role models. And again, this idea of turnaround role models. So, you know, I taught a student who's now in year 12, and they did quite a lot of X. And actually, when they stopped, they realized school's really fun, and you know, now their life is great, whatever it is, but in a more convincing way than I've just articulated that there. Or potentially, you know, to talk about the negative consequences of continuing to do whatever they do, and that's tricky to get right, but sometimes needs to be done. So anyway, we do the motivation piece, and that might work, but often it doesn't. And then if it doesn't, if we've tried to persuade students, or indeed if we persuade students but they keep doing the undesirable thing, we need to think about this reverse side of habit, of what can we do to impede habits. One thing that you can do is change the context. So if, you know, you're always calling out, well, it might be a move within the room, it might be a change to another classroom. Those are quite obvious things, again, that we often do. What we might do a little bit less often is look at the pattern of our lessons and say, well, is there a moment at which students start acting up? Maybe I should just reverse things, and we'll do a bit of writing before the discussion, because when we do discussion and then we do writing, that's the point that students kind of start losing track of what you want them to do. So part of it is these changes in the context. And then part of it is put quite well by Richard Thaler, is this idea of just adding sludge. So in the same way that you can sign up for a free trial in about three clicks on a website, and then to cancel your free trial, you've got to like ring up a expensive phone line that no one ever picks up. Anything that just kind of impedes students from doing the thing that you want them to do. So if kids are standing up and wandering around the classroom a bit of sludge is to say, well, actually, you need to put up your hand and ask for permission before you wander around the classroom, that kind of thing. So what you're looking at is ways, if we think about, and we haven't talked a huge about what habit is, but the key thing to remember about habit is it's this tight link between a stimulus and a response. So whenever I get stuck, I give up and chat to my neighbour and say, well, okay, what can we do? The context change might be to move the neighbour or move you. The sludge might be to say, well, okay, whenever you get stuck, before you do anything, I want you to look back in your book or write down three things that you are stuck on and then ask me about them, things like that. So you're trying to, the important thing is to break this link so that hopefully you form this new, more desirable habit where whenever I get stuck, I look back in my book and then productively solve my problem.
Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, you said in the section about if students are acting habitually, you can make the action harder and add in friction. And I just thought, you know, take this out of a classroom context. I just thought this is a great habit for me to get into. And I've tried it a few times. You know, you mentioned about chocolate on the top shelf. Yeah. I just really try powerfully not to buy any chocolate and then make sure that obviously I live quite a long way from the shop. So it's quite an effort to actually get it. I think I should cycle more to work. So I park my car at that, you know, my parents' mum's house around the corner, and you know, I have to cycle in the morning because it's too far to go and get the car from. So maybe do this, but thinking back into a classroom context again, you know, we're all going to go back to school in a couple of weeks, and I've probably potentially got a year seven class. And you think that I'm not stereotyping that year sevens always do this, but you may have students that habitually shout out answers. And I really like the example that you've given there, that, you know, you can give some time to say, right, write down your answer first before you think about shouting these things out, and kind of break that habit and kind of make a new one so that the students can kind of, you know, be more productive in the lesson.
Nailers, Natter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, let's get into teachers, Harry, if we might do now. So obviously, you know, we're hoping that this book's coming out in the next couple of days, and there'll be lots of people who will be buying this to kind of go back in when they're planning their professional development for next year, for example. So a big question, what kind of things could we ask teachers to change, and how can we encourage teachers to make those changes?
Yeah, so the thing to remember about teachers is that they're human beings, much like students. And so exactly the same barriers to change apply, and exactly the same principles of encouraging change apply. But in terms of the barriers, some of them are a little bit more acute. So, for example, if I've taught such and such topic for 10 years, I've probably got quite a nice way of introducing it. And if I've taught year seven in the same classroom for several years, probably got quite a good way of getting them into the classroom. And teachers have got their autonomy and also just the habits they've developed through bitter experience and trial and error. So anytime you're going to teachers and saying, hey, how about we try a different entry routine or a different this or a different that? In addition to all the other reasons you might not want to change, there's this kind of block just from the fact of like, well, whatever you're offering is going to have to be about 10 times better than what I'm already doing because I'm super busy and I'm already in a habit that works for me. So I think the key thing in identifying things to change, if you have to change things, is again, picking things which are really simple, but really meaningful. So my favorite example of a powerful habit for teachers is an exit ticket, because it's a really tiny thing to do, you know, like 3-4 minutes at the end and just have a look at what students have written. But it's incredibly powerful because it gives you an insight into what they've understood at the end of every lesson. And it then allows you to plan differently next lesson. And it kind of helps you to tighten up your planning and your lesson objectives and so on as you try formulating the exit ticket. So it's a lever, basically. It's like, you know, it's something really small that you fit in that can potentially have a huge effect. Get another example that I talk about comes from working with Josh Goodrich on change. He said, well, you know, I'm worried about the kind of questions teachers are asking and whether or not they're getting at misconceptions. And we talked through various options and we said, well, okay, what if we ask teachers to bring to the departmental meeting once a week a set of the most intriguing misconceptions that they've come across? So you're not saying, do this, do that, fill in a form in triplicate. It's quite an easy thing to do. But at the same time, by doing that, you're asking teachers to come up with good questions that will reveal misconceptions and to actually use those questions at an appropriate time. So in terms of what we ask teachers to do, small things that are useful, in terms of how all the same principles around, you know, like have you found a reason to sort of demonstrate that this is actually worthwhile? Are teachers experiencing the value of doing it? Do they see their peers doing the same stuff? Are you helping them to plan when and where to use whatever the change is? Are you making it easy for them? And just, you know, just sort of a couple of concrete things. If you think about, I don't want to tar all schools with this, many school bulletins. It's, you know, multiple pages, loads of different bullet points, not in any particular order. And often these bulletins do not get read or used by anyone. It's like, oh, it was in the bulletin. Well, no one read the bulletin. So helping teachers to be really, make it really easy to, well, okay, there's loads of things we could tell you, but today or this week, just think about these two things because they're the things we're really worried about. And then just in terms of making it easy, you know, how many times have you been asked to like find the spreadsheet, move it here, move it there? Like, well, again, teachers are busy. You know, if you want them to do a thing, put the spreadsheet in the email and just make it super simple for them. So yeah, just apply all these same ideas that we've talked about using with students in order to make change easy, attractive, simple for teachers.
Great stuff. And again, the chapter map, how can we encourage teachers to change, and the companion website, really, really useful. One thing again, Harry, and I'll keep mentioning we're going back to school very shortly, but you can imagine, can't you, the inset days are, of course, the law these days. It seems to be that everybody has to start something new at the beginning of the academic year. So we'll be all having an inspiring and motivating, no doubt, presentation. Probably not so much about results this time, because we kind of knew what they were going to be, but around this is the year that we're going to do X and Y. But what I like again about the book is that when teachers, it says, if teachers mean to act, then forget. And I'm just talking about myself here, you know, someone who's been teaching for 21, 22 years. I'm the person that you said there that's got the solids, liquids and gases lesson in a box that I've probably been using for the last goodness knows how many years. And I like it. And I think it works really well. And somebody might come up with a new way of doing it that might be much better, and I'll try it. But then when it's raining and it's a Wednesday afternoon and it's November, I'm quite likely to revert to that. So what I like about this book is that you've kind of covered all of those bases about, you know, what can you, and it's really simple in that one page. You know, you've even kind of followed your own advice in the chapter, haven't you, about making it simple. I could pick up that book and go, right, okay, if I mean to act and forget, ask teachers to commit, help them to recall those commitments and kind of share that with other people in the department as well. So it's really, really user-friendly, isn't it, the book? Okay, so in speaking of that, in terms of how we can use the book, how do you suggest that the listener could maybe use this book with their teams?
once they've bought a copy for everyone, more seriously, I think you can pick whichever bit of it strikes, sort of seems useful, and just work on that. So like, you know, you could do all of these different things, but what we see whenever researchers try and do things is they'll just try and use one of these strategies, and quite often that will have a worthwhile effect. So it's picking the thing that interests or bothers you. So maybe the thing is students, you know, seem really committed but don't actually act on their commitments, and then okay, we're going to have a look at chapter 3, which is all about that stuff. And once you've honed in on a thing that you and your colleagues really care about, loads of ways you could do it. And you could pick, so there's a workshop for each chapter, so you could have a look at the dilemma that the workshop poses, talk it all through, and then look at what I've suggested. You could read the chapter together and then look at the sort of prompts as you go through, saying, well, okay, which of these prompts could we use? You could just all bring your own, all read the chapter, all bring your own dilemma or challenge, and then talk through how the ideas of the chapter fit, might help with that challenge. Whatever you want to do, basically, it'd be a question of focusing in on a bit of it, talk it through, and then just use it to see, does it offer you a fresh perspective on some of the challenges that you face? And some of the chapters you might say, no, I don't think that's going to work for me. I don't think that's going to work for our kids. Fine, drop it. But I'd be disappointed if you could read the whole book and not find something where you and your team could just work a little bit harder on, okay, helping students plan their homework, okay, ways of communicating that actually the norm is to try really hard in this class, whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, a privilege to get not one but two copies in advance of publication. And obviously I haven't shared that wider than that, but we will be using this in our teacher kind of book group that we have at school. And I think it's probably one of the most usable and practical books that we've done there, because you can, you know, read that yourself, bring it to there, and then the workshops, like you said, there are really kind of, you know, going to stimulate discussion, aren't they? And lots of ideas will come out of that. And then you can kind of revisit, can't you? And when it does get to those busy days of October, November, the one page, you know, kind of summaries of the chapter, the flow charts that you can use in your own classroom, really, really practical, really, really simple, and really, really usable. Harry, do you mind if we just finish off? And I don't know, I know you're a busy man, and I'm going to tempt you into the vinyl suite, hopefully in a minute. We'll see how you feel about that one. But before that, I'm always conscious of reading authors' works back to them, but I just think that the conclusion is really, really powerful and really, really sums up kind of the feel of the book. So do you mind if I just kind of finish with that conversation? So every day in every lesson, teachers are forced to decide what next. The more we help students form habits of success, the easier this becomes. The more we inspire them to act, the less pressure we have put on them. The more detailed their commitments, the more likely they are to act. The easier it is to start, the more likely they are to do so. The more we help them keep going, the better the chance that change sticks. The more we discourage undesirable habits, the more likely they are to stop. And the more we use the same strategies with teachers, the easier change will be for them. And in terms of inspiring and motivating me, just reading that, Harry, I mean, it's absolutely, you know, summarizes it really, really clearly, doesn't it? It's an excellent book.
That's lovely to hear. Thank you. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. We're trying to, you know, teachers are super busy. I hope that this offers something that just makes that job a little bit easier and nudges students in the right direction a little bit more.
Excellent. Right. So I do this feature, and I'm sorry to ask you to do this feature, but it's quite good in terms of it gives people a little bit more of an insight. So what I'm going to ask you now is, we have at school the vinyl suite, as I say every single week, which is where myself and High Noon, as he is on Twitter, reside. We do actually do some work, Harry. Obviously, we don't just sit there listening to records. However, you could say it's a habit that on a Friday afternoon we do can put some vinyl on. So I'll just kind of ask you whether there's a particular song or a particular piece of music that either has kind of had a big effect on you professionally, or is something that you use, or something that kind of has a story behind it. So have you got one piece of music that you would recommend to the listener?
The song that sprang to mind is a song I've not thought about or listened to very much for quite a long time. But because you've got this prompt, sort of like, you know, it's important as a teacher, not just, you know, a song that you like. But the nice thing about it is it allows me to talk about the music that I love most in the world. And I will die on the hill that the best music in the entire world, by a factor of about 10, comes from Mali in West Africa. And there are just a so many brilliant musicians working on guitars, desert blues, the kora, which is a West African harp. And it's just all fantastic. I don't think I've ever listened to a bad Malian album, but I won't impose all of that on everyone now. One of the best Malians, one of the most successful, and one of the people who sort of brought this music to the Western world, I guess, 90s onwards, was called Ali Faka Touré. And he was, in particular, a guitarist and just, you know, did these records and then worked on these beautiful collaborations. And in my first school, I had an album of his on my, like, recording on my laptop. And I would hit, like, get in about, like, 7.15, 7.30, so I could do an hour's planning before everything started. And I'd hit play on this record. So it was different records every time, but it was quite often this one. And I think it was about track six. There's a song called Lacedan. And it's having started out quite meditatively and slowly. The pace kind of picks up, and there's this beautiful, smooth rhythm, you just get this kind of gorgeous sense of kind of, it would always make me feel a sense of flow, and it always seemed to kick in. It must have kicked in about 8:15, just at the point that, like, more and more kids are arriving, and you know you're running out of time to finish planning your lessons. And I just remember several times as this song, the pace picks up and the flow kicks in, this song kind of being like, I'm like doing all this stuff, but I'm kind of feeling good as I do it. And so that is the song that I'm going to offer you for this week. However, if you're not a Malian music devotee, you should use that as your springboard to discover his many other albums, his son, Vieux Faka Touré, Too Many Djibouti, and just, you know, keep going from there.
And again, listener, this is why we do this section, isn't it? This is definitely why we do this section. And so you'll be able to hear that piece of music now. Okay, Harry, that is superb. Thank you very much for that. And that's a golden entry into the vinyl suite that we've not had before. So that is fantastic. Okay, last question, if you don't mind. So obviously, we said the book is released this Friday, and we're hoping to turn this podcast around fairly quickly, so it should be out to coincide with the book being released. But can you tell us a little bit more about maybe where you're out speaking about the book, where people can find the book, and if you're going to do any more, like I said, any engagements about that. Just tell listeners a little bit more, but we can find more about you as well.
So you can find the book in all good book web shops, which is to say you can get it on Amazon and also Routledge, the publisher. And at the moment, they're going for the same price and the same postage and packing. So I'll leave you to decide which one of those you should do. I have blogged regularly at a site which is improvingteaching.co.uk. That's kind of slipped this year, but I've got various tidbits I came across from writing the book and stuff that didn't make it into the book that I'm going to be publishing, I'm hoping, in the autumn. I tweet about as often as I blog at the moment, but again, try and get back into good habits there. And that's H Fletcher Wood, without any hyphens or anything. And then on my website, you can find my email if you're keen to or desperate to get in touch for anything.
Great stuff. And will you be doing any more speaking engagements? Because I've had the pleasure to watch you a couple of times on the research ed circuit. When I could cram myself into the room, Harry, let me tell you, I think of one particular national conference where, we were absolutely jammed in there. I think you maybe were trialing some of the ideas for this book, I think, as I recall. But that was a great talk. So are you doing anything on that front?
I don't have anything booked at the minute, but Phil, as soon as I have them booked, I will come back to you and let you know. No, it's. I think we're just gearing up for in-person stuff again. Nothing on my book. Nice, quiet autumn in that sense.
Okay, good stuff. Well, okay. And if anybody is listening, wants to check out Harry, I'm sure there's some clips on YouTube of you appearing at various research ed conferences through the years. I'm pretty sure I've seen some of those. Harry, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are. And just to remind everybody, it's Habits of Success, Getting Every Student Learning, and it will be available as soon as this podcast comes out. Thank you again, Harry.
Thanks so much for having me, Phil.
Grammar's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Grammar's Natter, just talking to teachers.